From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Taylor Swift is in the middle of a bitter custody battle over her early music. Then, director Trey Edward Schultz gave actress Taylor Russell the script for his new film, Waves, and he also gave her a mixtape.
Because the script was synced up with music, these artists, Kanye West, Frank Ocean, SZA, Solange, Beach House, when you hear the songs, you kind of know what world you're in.
And Joshua Hami from Queens of the Stone Age returns to his desert roots. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Pop star Taylor Swift is in an ongoing battle with her former record company, Big Machine. Back in August, Swift announced that she would re-record her entire catalog to regain ownership of her music. Now, she says Big Machine won't allow her to perform her old songs at the American Music Awards or in an upcoming Netflix documentary. Jem Aswad is senior music editor at Variety. He's been covering the story. Jem, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So before we get into the current back and forth between Swift and her old record company, remind us the history here.
Well, it's a long and fairly tangled history. The upshot of it is the fact that Taylor Swift's first six albums are owned by Big Machine Records, which was run by Scott Porchetta. He sold the company to an investment group led by Scooter Braun, Justin Bieber, and Ariana Grande's manager, who is someone who Taylor has not gotten along with in the past, who she is accused of bullying her. And, you know, there was a social media post a couple of years ago where Justin Bieber, Scooter, and Kanye West, you know, at the height of her dust up with Kanye West and Kim Kardashian, you know, they posted something like, "Hey, what's up, Taylor?" You know, something mocking. And she's never really gotten over that. So when Scooter Braun bought the rights to her first six albums, she was quite unhappy. She said it was a worst-case scenario. She talked about how he has bullied her. And that went on for a while, died down a bit, flared up again last night with this social media post.
What did Taylor Swift say in her social media post, and why has it created such a new controversy?
She claims that Big Machine said that they were not going to allow her to play any songs from those first six albums on the American Music Awards. The American Music Awards has a sort of, Artist of the Decade tribute planned for her. They also said that they were blocking the use of her music in a Netflix special. Now, it's not clear that Big Machine has the right to do that. They could do it with a Netflix special because that would involve playing the original studio recordings of the songs, which Big Machine owns. But as far as I know, and as far as most of the music industry books we've looked at show, she can play her songs anywhere she wants. You know, that is not a record label issue. That is not the recorded master. So it's not really clear what's going on there, whether Big Machine kind of threatened her, trying to get her to come to the table. And Big Machine also claimed that Taylor owed them several million dollars. Taylor snapped right back and said, no, actually, you owe me almost $8 million, I believe, in unpaid songwriter royalties. So it's kind of hard to parse who is actually right or wrong. But the upshot is Big Machine has not denied that they had threatened to prevent her from playing those songs.
Braun was Kanye West's manager when he released the 2016 video for Famous, in which Taylor Swift and a host of other celebrities were depicted nude. Taylor Swift called it revenge porn. So how does that color this whole argument now that's being more or less litigated in social media?
What Taylor has done very skillfully is blow it up into a bigger issue about artists' rights, which is something that not only is something she's fought very aggressively for over the years and actually advanced some things. For example, in 2015 when Apple Music was not paying royalties on music that was played during trial subscriptions. She managed to get them in the course of a single day to change that policy, not just for her, but for all artists. And she's in some ways conflating this into a larger issue about artists' rights, which is something she believes in very strongly and something that is really at the heart of her whole dispute with Big Machine. She has a very hard time accepting the fact that someone with whom she has a history like she's had with Scooter Braun controls her first six albums.
We're talking with Jem Aswad, senior music editor at Variety. Taylor Swift has called on her fans to take some sort of action in support of her fight with Big Machine. Some people are now saying she went too far. What's happening on that front?
Well, as part of the response this morning, Big Machine criticized her for bringing her fans into this situation and saying that, you know, people who work for the company didn't feel safe. You know, how could you do that? Things like that. I mean, you know, people, as you may have noticed, can say some really nasty things on social media. And a lot of artists have swarms of fan armies who just like attack on social media. And it's not really clear how dangerous that actually is. But when an artist's fans cluster together and attack, it can be an alarming thing. So they may be saying menacing things to Big Machine employees or Scott Borchetta or Scooter Braun or his family or whoever, because people do kind of horrible things in these situations, you know. And she not only enlisted her fans, she indirectly reached out to other artists, and she even reached out to the people in the Carlyle Group, which is the investment group that Scooter Braun leads, that bought the company, trying to sway things that way. You know, I mean, this was buckshot, you know. I mean, she really took no prisoners with it.
It feels like we can look at this whole thing in two different ways. One is kind of a fundamental business dispute about royalties and ownership of masters. The other one is a very personal fight between two people who don't like each other. What do you think is the fair characterization?
It's both. It's completely both. At the heart of it is the ownership of the music. And what Taylor is doing that is so smart and so strategic is she's cutting away all the nuance of it and saying it's about her right to own and control her own songs. And, you know, when you're in the court of public opinion, that kind of simplicity makes all the difference, okay? And she has done a very good job of reducing this very complex situation to that one issue.
Jem Aswad is senior music editor for Variety. For all the latest entertainment news, go to variety.com. Jem, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Coming up on The Frame, the director and co-star of the film Waves wanted to depict an authentic teenage experience. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Waves is the latest film from writer and director Trey Edward Schultz, who also made the thriller It Comes at Night. Waves is partly a film about Florida teenagers who sometimes party hard, swim with manatees, and make mistakes, but it's also about the importance of friends and family when tragedy strikes. Almost like a documentary filmmaker, Schultz brings the viewer into the most intimate moments of a home racked by grief. I recently spoke with Schultz and with actress Taylor Russell. She plays Emily, the quiet, empathic daughter in the film. Let's start with a father-son scene from Waves. This is between characters played by Sterling K. Brown and Kelvin Harrison Jr.
We are not afforded the luxury of being average. Gotta work 10 times as hard just to get anywhere. I don't push you because I want to. I push you because I have to. Do you hear what I'm saying, son? Do you hear what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking with Sterling and Kelvin about that scene, what was important for them in terms of how that scene was going to play out?
Well, it had to be honest. It had to be truthful. But my first instinct with that scene was my experience and basing it on the relationship with my stepdad and the way he pushed me and everything. But then when I talked to Kelvin a lot, we talked about, you know, commonalities and the dynamics between our fathers and the way his father pushed him for music. And that scene kind of turned into the talk, you know, that Kelvin and I talked about that a lot of African-American men have with their sons. So it really all stemmed from like me collaborating with Kelvin on the script at that phase, and then it shifted through that and him talking about his dad, and then it just continued with Sterling. And at the end of the day, we're all just trying to make it honest and real, you know.
This is a portrait of teens. Yes, it's a story about a family, and yes, it's a story about something that goes horribly wrong, but it's about teens and how they live their daily lives and how they get along and don't get along and how they party. And I wonder, from the very earliest idea that you had about this film, how central was that idea of the teen experience to the story you wanted to tell?
It definitely started with that. You know, that was sort of apart from the DNA from the beginning. But I mean, aspects of this story has been brewing for the better part of a decade. So I really do think the first images and ideas were when I was a teen in high school myself. And yeah, I didn't know what the movie was, but it was teens, it was music, and it was images. But I didn't know how that all clicked and connected, you know.
And Taylor, how did music help tell the story? Because there's some song cues that are very specific in this film.
It helps you build the world. It helps you know what story you're trying to tell. These artists, Kanye West, Frank Ocean, SZA, Solange, Beach House, like all these people, Radiohead. I mean, it's so specific. And I think when you hear the songs, you kind of know what world you're in. And so as an actor, when often we only hear the soundtrack after the movie comes out, it's a big gift because the script was synced up with music.
The markings on your surface, your speckled face.
And you could play a song as a scene went on and then play the next song, and it was really interactive. So everybody who read the script got the exact idea of what music was going to be used in the movie. If
assuming
he got
they
could
clear it, assuming your music supervisor.
I asked Trey,
very lucky, man.
I was asking him probably for like 10 months, did you get Kanye? Did you get Frank Ocean? Like, I just wanted to know where they were at, and he got everything.
Do you have particular things that you respond to that feel authentic? And there are conversations that you have with him about the character that help you ground her more in your mind?
Well, Trey, we had a lot of conversations the entire summer about, you know, is this truthful to like what it would be like as a young 16-year-old female? There was a lot of certain things. There was like a masturbation scene that she had in the script originally that is not there anymore, that we didn't even shoot it, but he asked like, would it happen this way? There was a lot of stuff like that didn't really help the story, I think, and kind of maybe would have taken away from her journey.
It felt like to me as we were working together, Emily was evolving and the story was evolving, mm-hmm. and we were attuned and adapting every day. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I feel like, unless I'm totally wrong, I feel like we got to that day and we were like, do we need this?
No, we did. We got to the day
right
and
anymore.
I was like, I don't know if this is necessary. And you were
like
I don't know if it is either.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think it was just kind of like that. You really like, I've talked about this so much, but you don't get that with a collaborator as a director. That it doesn't happen. It's usually so finite and all mapped out, and as it should be for certain things, and it was in this way too. But Trey was just so, he's such a good listener.
One of the central conceits of the film is the private life of a family and the private life of teens.
Yeah.
And that is a idea, but when you're looking to execute it visually, what does that mean in terms of how the camera is going to observe these people?
Well, it was always motivated by Ty or Emily, because the movie's a very subjective experience to each protagonist when they're taking over the story. So we're always just trying to be true to them, whether that's spinning around through a car with them because that's what love in that moment feels like, or if it's isolating Emily and her environment away from everything, static, not doing anything, or, you know, her ducking around and hearing her parents in a giant, huge fight conversation. But we're still sort of retaining the spirit of her point of view and how we're back distancing, zooming in and honing in like she would be hearing it.
What have you done for her?
What's that supposed
What
to
are
mean?
You doing for her?
What are you talking about?
You're not there for her. You were never there for her, even before.
No,
you show up You play Mr. Nice Guy and you leave all the work for me. Is that what you want me to do?
What the hell are you talking about?
You want me to go take care of her again for you?
What are you talking about?
You pushed him! You pushed him!
But when your character, Taylor, goes on a road trip with another character played by Lucas Hedges, it almost feels like this is like, you know, the high-end version of Super 8 vacation film, that you are observing your cameras as they're actually taking this trip.
Completely. It was the first thing that we shot. And then there was like a week after that before going into actual production. And we did a real road trip with the whole crew. We were in a huge bus, like the condensed crew. And most of that stuff just happened on a whim. Lucas and I would be like dancing in the middle of the street, or things would happen and we'd turn around and Drew and Trey would be there like running after us with a camera. And a lot of it was just in the moment and really spontaneous.
We're talking with writer-director Trey Edward Schultz and actor Taylor Russell about the movie Waves. You have played a lot of festivals, but I know that you don't really like watching your film with audiences. So how do you get a sense of how people are reacting to it? And Taylor, you can jump in here too. Do you get like conversations that you're overhearing? Are people coming up to you and telling you how they react?
Absolutely. I mean, for myself, the best indication is like just being in person after a screening when people connect with it, because it's real and you feel it, you know. I don't think the movie's for everyone, but the people that it's for, I feel it's really for, and they really connect. And I've had some of the most humbling conversations and energy from those people. It's been one of the most beautiful things of my life, no joke.
Yeah, we had a screening in DC, and it was magical because there was a lot of kids there in the back who were at this theater school, and somebody said something like, "I don't know if kids are really like this," or he had a question about how it would affect youth, and all the youth at the back stood up and wanted to speak about how they felt about the film. And one boy was holding the mic and his hand was shaking, and he was talking about how he saw himself in these characters and that this movie inspired him to go home and talk to his dad and bridge that gap. And then we saw him the next day at a Q&A at the school, and he brought his dad.
Oh my goodness.
And talked to Sterling and Trey, and it just was, I mean, I think you never really realize the impact the work that you're in can have on people, and to see it firsthand is the most humbling thing, and also makes you feel like, okay, what I'm doing is worthwhile. Like, this all means something. It's so important.
Absolutely.
And it's like such a blessing.
Trey, I saw you not that long ago at the Middleburg Film Festival, which is run by Sheila Johnson, who is an amazing African-American woman. And her race is important because she saw your movie at the Telluride Film Festival. Yeah. And I saw her right after she saw it, and she was visibly upset by it. Yeah. And you said earlier, this is not a film for everybody. And she said something, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's a close quote, "I don't know that I can show this film to my people." Mm. And what she meant by that is African Americans. Yeah. And I'm wondering, is that kind of reaction, as visceral and emotional as it is, proof to you of how the movie might be working, even though she's wrestling with it and she did show it at her festival in Middleburg?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, man, at the end of the day, it's meant to be a subjective, immersive experience, and that's going to be different for any viewer, you know? And all we're trying to do is make it honest to these characters in this story as well as we know it, you know? So it's been fascinating to hear different reactions like that, you know, these screenings we're doing, like DC and Atlanta to like London and all these different races and cultures and their reaction. And the beautiful thing, though, is honestly, like, we are seeing a lot of people that seem to deeply connect to it and like talk about relationships with their families and trying to break down barriers and put in new lines of communication. So, but yeah, I mean, I can't control any reaction. Clearly the movie's working in some way, you know.
Trey and Taylor, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Love NPR.
Yeah.
Waves, written and directed by Trey Edward Schultz, is in theaters starting today. Up next on The Frame, Joshua Hami from Queens of the Stone Age goes back to the desert to quench his creative thirst.
I will always love you how I do. Let go of a prayer for you.
Waves. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The musician and record producer Joshua Hami is from the desert east of L.A., but no matter what he's doing, that's his home base. And he does a lot of stuff. He's the frontman for Queens of the Stone Age. He's also in Eagles of Death Metal. And Hami collaborates with lots of people outside those bands. Dave Grohl of the Foo Fighters, British singer PJ Harvey, Iggy Pop, and even Elton John. Hami's latest project is a throwback to his communal instincts, born in the desert of Joshua Tree more than 20 years ago.
My name is Joshua Hami. This is The Desert Sessions, Volume 11 and 12. There's no music school for people like me. It's all in the positive friction of collaboration that you learn things and kind of develop your communication skills. And I think I've always had an interest in seeing how other bands and other artists do their thing, you know? And so that's kind of how the Desert Sessions was born, to take people out to Joshua Tree, this studio called Rancho de la Luna, which is three houses on a property there, and improvise music together with people that do and mostly don't know each other. There's the gift of nothing out in the desert. I consider myself sort of lucky to have been born there. You're kind of dwarfed by the landscape. You know, when you get out there, there's no one there. It's done in secret. It's really a way to rekindle an early relationship with music and so to ask, do you remember why you started playing? You know, someone has an idea and it triggers something in you and you watch people say things like, oh, if we do this, then this. And that excitement is contagious. Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top. I've had the luxury of knowing Billy Gibbons for over a decade now. The song that he sings called Move Together, a friend that owns the studio, Dave, I said, hand me that looper. And it's just a little box. Turn it on and that's the loop that you hear. This kind of crippled atonal loop. And when I took it outside to Billy, he and I immediately, you could hear the melody and hear this thing. And he was saying, and you could sing this and maybe this lyric. And when he was all, he wrote the lyrics. And when he was done, I said, not me, you. You know? And he sang that vocal over just this loop.
She don't like my empty whiskey bottles. I don't like the smell of her hairspray.
And it was, what was wonderful is I look at Billy as a piece of art, and it was great to reframe him in a frame that was hand-built by these people out in the desert with love and care that is completely alien to how you would normally hear Billy. It is a really an intensely creative and talented list on this Desert Sessions. It's Libby Grace, who's supremely talented country singer, but who has yet to ever play live or go out and record anything.
New age, burning of a page, a brand new dream to sail. Ain't far from who you really are, and it's just as well.
There's something about moving at the speed of inspiration, and also there's three houses on this property, and you eat food together at the top one, and that walk between houses in the night, or, you know, walking through the desert, creates this kind of staircase logic where you think of the answers. It's not the gear that solves problems or solves artistic Rubik's cubes. It's that walk when you're not playing and talking and thinking about what you've done out there. Matt Berry is an English treasure, English comedian, actor, who's just wonderful.
Okay, so I'm here with John, who is the lead singer.
Josh,
who is the lead singer of the band Queens of the Stone Age. And this, I imagine, is where you record all of your music, is it?
Yeah, I'm most of the music.
I've got to say, some of this stuff looks... I mean, have you kept this for sort of, you know, sentimental reasons? Is this like your grandfather's or something?
No,
why this is?
He and I have become friends over the last 8 or 9, 10 years. Instead of going out and going to bars or something, we just hang in and create instead. And so it just happened to be the right moment at the right time. this time.
I realized at this point I made a terrible mistake.
Matt!
I was playing very bad over.
Matt!
And I needed a rest.
The first couple dozen sessions felt like the full length of my wingspan, but now these are built on top of the older previous volumes, and it really has helped to create a much broader wingspan that's pulling from farther and wider than ever before, you know. It's a wonderful thing even to just sit there and watch two people that never would have played together, bonding and giggling and conspiring over something, tinkering on the same art machine, you know. So it's wonderful to watch. You know, it's a really blessed thing to be able to do this for a living for any length of time, and there's no guarantee. I always wait for someone to ring my doorbell and say, we've all agreed we don't like your music anymore, you have to go. And I think I would probably say, okay, well, that was good, that was a long time, thank you, you know. I think music is a lot like bowling. You don't have to be good at it to enjoy it. And it really is the expression where words kind of fail to communicate how you feel. Music really does this wonderful job of that. It's the only thing I know of that's never wrong. You may not like some style of music, but it isn't wrong, you know? And so it's been very helpful for me to leave tough things behind and find things that are worth following and chasing.
That is it for today, but don't forget to tune in to The Frame Weekend. You can hear it Saturday at 2. Thanks to Taylor McFerrin, who provides our opening theme music. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here Monday at the Moen Broadcast Center.